You will open your Bibles, and tonight, especially without PowerPoint, this is a great time to have a verse-by-verse study, and I want to invite us to go to Acts chapter 27 and 28, the last two chapters in the book of Acts. We're going to call this the Island of Adventure, the Island of Adventure. And perhaps our minds may go to some tropical island and thinking about going to the Bahamas for a pleasure trip. Well, it may have ended up pleasurable for Paul, but the journey there and the first experiences how he got there was very rough. In fact, in order to appreciate Acts chapter 28 and his experiences on this island of adventure, we need to understand what he goes through in Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27 is Luke's record of Paul's journey to Rome. Began in Jerusalem, and then they boarded a ship on the coast of Palestine and traveled to, ultimately, to this island that we'll be introduced to at the first part of Acts chapter 28. If you want to know about sailing in the first century, if you did a close study of Acts chapter 27, I think we learn a lot about it. In reading about it, I've learned a lot more than I ever knew about sailing, and particularly about the difficulties that Paul and that crew on those ships encountered. But to set the stage, remember that Paul has been in prison in Caesarea for 2 years. It doesn't appear that he's going to get a fair trial, and so as a Roman citizen, he has this privilege. And he acts on this privilege of appealing to Caesar. And he is told, "Unto Caesar you have appealed, unto Caesar you shall go." And so the way to get to Rome was by ship. And so he, under the care of a centurion, boarded a ship along with other prisoners, ultimately bound for Rome. It wasn't long into the journey that the ship in which he was a passenger began to face contrary winds. That's verse 4 of Acts 27. Then difficult winds making slow progress off of the island of Cnidus. They did arrive on the island of Crete at a port called Fair Havens. And here they stayed for a while until after the holy day, known as the Day of Atonement, the annual fast day, which in the year 60 A.D., which many believe is the year that Paul made this journey, that fast day, the Day of Atonement, was on September 24th. I give you that information as a backdrop to this information, that the optimal period for navigating the Mediterranean Sea at that time was from April to October. Those were the months where it was relatively safe. Sudden storms notwithstanding, it was relatively safe during that time to travel by ship. So if it's after the fast day, September 24th, we're getting into October here. And so now conditions for sea travel in the Mediterranean Sea are growing worse and worse. And so the storm that Paul ultimately encountered on this journey was not all that unexpected in that day and time. And Paul even warns, we find in Acts 27, verses 9 and 10, he warns the captain of the ship not to proceed. You see, during those winter months, ships would often dock and just wait out that season of time when it would be unwise to travel. And so he warns them, don't make this trip or you'll suffer the loss of the ship. But his warnings go unheeded. And so while they're on that island of Crete, they want to make a journey, I think about 40 miles further, to another port on that same island to winter there. But while making that journey, they encounter a northeast wind, the Euroclilo, or some versions have the Euroclodon. Look at verses 14 and 15 of Acts 27. Not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclodon. When the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. Another version states it, a wind of hurricane force. We understand that, don't we? A wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm, could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. There's movies made about this kind of thing, right? So here was a ship. This is hurricane force winds. And the ship, they're unable to steer it in the direction they want to go, and so they let the winds carry the ship. And so they're forced to undergird the ship. We read about that in verses 18 and 19. They end up lightening the ship of all its cargo and ultimately the tackle. And they saw neither sun nor stars for many days. In fact, let's read verses 18 through 20 of Acts 27. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. They're in the midst of a typhoon, hurricane force winds. The ship is being battered and beaten and directed just out into the open waters of the Mediterranean Sea. They have no control on their direction at this point, and they're fearing the loss of their lives. But Paul, the prisoner Paul, stands up and he says, and he affirms to them, he encourages them, saying that an angel of the Lord appeared to me, and no loss of life will occur among the passengers of this ship. And when some tried to get into the skiff to abandon ship, he warned them, you must stay on the ship in order to be saved. They encounter so much more. Let's go down to verse 39 of Acts 27. Now when it was day, and this is after they've done some soundings, they realize that the sailors realize they're drawing nearer and nearer to land. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas meet, they ran the ship aground, and the prow or the bow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broke up by the violence of the waves. So they've run aground, the bow is stuck, the stern is being destroyed by the big waves. Those in charge are wanting to kill the prisoners lest they escape. But the centurion, wanting to save the life of Paul, stops that from happening. So basically they say, grab hold of anything that floats and make your way to land. And so they arrive on this beach. And just as Paul had stated by God's message to him, all 276 passengers of that ship made it safely to land. But now they're waterlogged on the beach of a bay of an island that they don't know exactly where it is. That brings us to chapter 28 of Acts, and I want to just focus in on the first 10 verses. We'll break it into four parts, just to help you follow along with me. And the first part I want to call Maltese hospitality. Verses 1 and 2. Now, when they had escaped, they then found out that the island was called Malta. And the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. And I did have a map of this Paul's fourth journey, his journey to Rome, and even a map of the island of Malta. But that is the island where they landed. They are waterlogged. They are physically exhausted. But now they've made it safely to land. Malta is a small island in the Mediterranean, about 18 miles long, 8 miles wide. Situated about 60 miles south of Sicily and 180 miles north and east of Africa. It was a territory of Rome. We'll find that there was a governor who ruled the island. His name was Publius. Someone wondered if he founded the grocery store chain Publix, but I don't think that's the case. But this is where they land. And the natives, you'll find in some versions, say, showed us unusual or extraordinary kindness. The natives, the Greek word there is barbaros. Sounds like a lot like barbarian, doesn't it? These barbarians, these natives, showed us unusual kindness. By the way, that word was used not to describe unkempt character, but that word was simply used to describe someone who didn't speak the Greek language. To the Greeks, other languages may sound like bar, 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 bar. Went to India. I heard some of that. Bar, 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 bar. I just could not make sense of Telugu language. But it doesn't mean that they were uncivilized savages. It means they spoke a different language. They weren't uncivilized savages at all, because we see that these natives of that island of Malta treat Paul and all the passengers of that shipwrecked ship with extraordinary kindness. Here's where I want to stop and make application. Sometimes, even when we've encountered a typhoon of sorts, we can encounter some kind people. Many of you, I'm sure, have stories of facing some difficulty in your life, and as a result, you encountered some people, some complete strangers, who showed you wonderful kindness. Let me take you to a place where many of us have sat and probably experienced it, and that's in the waiting room of a hospital. We're there because of a loved one, a family member, church family member. How many times have you spent time in an ICU waiting room, wanting and waiting to hear some news and praying for favorable news about a loved one that's back in ICU? And you meet other families in the ICU waiting room. And so many have developed strong connections with families in similar circumstances, had have encountered some very kind and loving people in so doing. Sometimes when we encounter storms, we also encounter some kind people. I think that's good for us to remember. But here's where I really want us to make application. Let's be those kind people that people encounter in times of storm, where we can minister to them in the name of Christ. There's Maltese hospitality, verses 1 and 2. Verses 3 through 6, Maltese fickleness. Maltese fickleness. Notice how fickle these people of Malta are. Verse 3, but when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, no doubt this is a murderer whom, though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live. One thing that impresses me here about Paul, we've seen what he's been through, a little bit of what he's been through. And now they finally made it to land. They're exhausted, they're wet, and they're cold because of rain that's even falling. And these complete strangers, the natives of the island, make a fire. They build a fire so that they can warm themselves. Paul, what does he do? He doesn't sit idly by. He goes out and gathers more firewood. Paul's a leader. And there's no task too small for him. I think that's very commendable and noteworthy and worthy of our imitation. He himself, even though he's one being served, wants to help out. But while he has gathered that firewood for the fire, because of the heat of that fire, that cold-blooded snake is now, because of the warmth, has gotten some warmth in him and even strikes out and bites Paul. Notice the interpretation of the natives of Malta. They're not uncultured barbarians, but they are superstitious believers in the gods. And they think, they see this venomous snake bite Paul, and they make this assumption. Well, he escaped fate. It was probably the justice of the gods that Paul die while out in the storm. But he's escaped the storm, but now justice is still going to be served, and they even assume he must have murdered someone because now the gods have caused this snake to bite Paul. Therefore, he is a murderer, and he is receiving justice from the gods. Interestingly, there's a writer of a Greek work, the Palatine Anthology, Statilius Flaccus, wrote about a shipwrecked sailor who suffered just this fate. And listen to what he wrote. Oh, he escaped the storm and the raging of the murderous sea, but as he lay stranded in the Libyan sand, not far from the beach and heavy with sleep at last, naked and destitute, weary as he was from the terrible shipwreck, the viper struck him dead. Why did he struggle against the waves? He did not escape the lot which was destined for him on land. That's an identical scenario that these natives are thinking has happened to Paul now. He's a murderer, and the gods have given him his punishment by that venomous snake, that viper, biting him. But Paul didn't die. Verse 5. He shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds, there's the fickleness, and said, he must be a god. Notice that fickleness. The snake bites him, they think, well, he must be a murderer and the gods are performing justice. They go all the way from that extreme now to, well, the venomous snake didn't kill him. He must be a god. He must be a god. There's that superstitious belief in the gods that is coming out in the way that they view these circumstances. Of course, this is not the first time in Acts you'll find superstitious worship of God's messengers. In Acts 14, we read about the inhabitants of Lystra, who tried to worship Paul and Barnabas. However, on Malta, they first believed Paul to be a murderer before they elevated him to the status of a god. At Lystra, they thought he was a god and ended up taking him outside, stoning him, and leaving him for dead. But now at Malta, Paul, by God's blessing, has survived storm, shipwreck, and now a snake bite. Number 3, Maltese blessing. Maltese blessing. Verse 7. In that region there was an estate of the leading citizen, the chief official of the island, whose name was Publius, who received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. So he's a man not only of power, but of means. And he takes Paul and company in and takes care of them, entertains them for three days. Makes me wonder, because he saw Paul survive the snake bite, the venomous snake, is he hoping Paul can do something for him? Notice the next verse. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and dysentery. Paul went into him and prayed, and he laid his hands on him and healed him. Paul and his company have been the recipients of kindness. That kindness is reciprocated in a powerful way by Paul praying for the father of Publius and his being healed. There's a particular disease indigenous to the island of Malta known as Malta fever, the cause of which was traced in the late 19th century to a microorganism in the milk of Maltese goats. And whether it was this malady that Publius' father was suffering from, we do not know. But I found it interesting that there were similar characteristics. Good news travels fast. They hear of the chief man's father being healed, and so other sick folk are brought to Paul for him to minister to them. Verse 9. So when this was done, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and were healed. May I make this application? Wherever we are, let's minister to others in the name of Christ. Where is Paul? He's on the island of Malta. Not his intended destination. Not the means of travel that he wanted. But he's on this island, shipwrecked on this island, and now encounters people who have actually been kind to him. And what does Paul do? He's kind to them with the power of God and healing the sick. Wherever we are, life may take us some places we really didn't want to be. But while we're there, let's serve others to the glory of God. Number 4, Maltese gratitude, verse 10. They, the people of Malta, also honored us in many ways. And when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. How long did they stay there? The next verse tells us they were there about 3 months. That's 3 months of hospitality. That's 3 months of doing these things that honored them. That's 3 months of building those relationships with those with the people of that island. I suspect, the scripture is silent, but I suspect that when they left, there were tears shed. And there was a fond farewell that went with Paul and the passengers of that ship. They honored us. They were thankful. Thankfulness in our lives is also so critical. But I want to go back into these verses and notice with you the sound of silence that was pretty striking. The sound of silence. Something that isn't said. A strange silence in our text. There's a glaring gap in this passage in a book that is all about the spread of the gospel. And while Paul is in Malta, as far as the scriptural record goes, there's no mention of evangelism. There's no mention of evangelism. Let me issue this warning. When we're expounding on the silence of Scripture, we better be very, very careful. But it was interesting to note that there was no specific mention of evangelism taking place, Paul preaching the gospel. Let me make 3 observations. Number 1, knowing what we do about Paul, I think we can assume with a great deal of confidence that he did proclaim the gospel. As much as we know about Paul, I can't imagine him being at a place for a few days, much less 3 months, and not talking to Jesus, not talking to people about Jesus. In fact, the purpose of these miracles we find in the book of Acts, they often created those opportunities. They were confirmation that these people were from God and their message was from God. And so what a platform on which to proclaim Jesus than these miracles that were done. Second, there is no mention of a church being planted there, but we have no firm reason to conclude that one was not. But it did make me think about this. What if Paul did preach the gospel? What if they just weren't receptive to the gospel? There's a debate today concerning missions and ministries of care. Some would say that the church should be involved in missions and just as much as in ministries of care. I think such a separating the two does harm. Because the fact is, the gospel proclamation with view of making disciples of Jesus is the primary calling of the local church. That is our mission, to teach others about Jesus. But yes, indeed, the church is also called to be compassionate. And we should be heavily involved in the ministry of mercy. But I think we should keep these hand in hand, reaching to others with in mercy and helping others in time of need, but in view of helping them come to know Christ, helping them learn about the gospel of Jesus and obeying the gospel. But what if those people to whom we minister in mercy are not receptive or even reject the gospel message? I want to suggest three things. First one is this. We can learn it's always right to do right, even if we can't accomplish the best. It's always right to do right, even if we can't accomplish the best. What are we saying? The best and greatest thing, what we need to work toward and hope for and pray for, is that the people to whom we minister, that they do come to know Christ, that they become Christians. But even when we do our best to accomplish that, and if they turn a deaf ear or they reject it, we still must do what's right and help them the best of our ability. As it's been said, if we're going to err, let's err on the side of mercy. Number two, we can learn that we never know the eventual outcome of our ministry of mercy. We can never know the eventual outcome. What if there weren't people baptized into Christ before Paul left? At the very least, those people could look back on a time, on interaction with Paul and his company, those Christians, and see the care that they gave. They could recall seeing those visual demonstrations of the power of God. And who knows, if they didn't immediately become Christians, how later on their hearts could be right to become Christians. Personally, I fully anticipate meeting some Maltese Christians in heaven who were converted while Paul was there. If they weren't converted while he was there, perhaps seeds were planted that later brought forth a harvest. What's the point? Let's go ahead and do the right, good, and kind thing, and let's leave the results to God. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 6 says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. In the context, that's talking about planting the gospel. I planted, Paul says. Apollos came and he watered. He did further teaching, but it was God who gave the increase. Perhaps at times, all that we can do, all that we can accomplish, are good deeds done in the name of Christ. Yet it may be those deeds of kindness that one day soften a heart or soften hearts that are receptive to the message of Jesus and bear great spiritual fruit. I think a third thing that we can learn is that it is right to serve our fellow man with the gifts that God has given to us. It's the right thing to do. If we truly love people, then we're going to do the right thing and serve others, but we're also going to have a gospel-centered and gospel-driven agenda to see them converted to Christ. They must go hand in hand. So let's be committed to that, to loving our neighbor with a Christ-driven agenda. But if he rejects our gospel, then, like Christ, let's continue to minister to him and leave the results to God. Galatians 6:10 says, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. But who knows? Maybe some of those all that we're reaching out to and doing good and ministering to them, by God's grace, one day can become a part of the household of faith because we reached out to them with the love and mercy of God. The island of Malta, an island of adventure. Paul wasn't headed there intentionally, but ended up there by the providence of God. Encountered some people, some complete strangers that were kind to him. Encountered some people with some needs that he, by the power of God, was able to meet. Let's learn from Paul to minister in the name of Christ in view of bringing them to Christ. But if they reject our pleas, our teaching. Let's show them the love of God anyway. And perhaps one day they will be more receptive to the gospel of Jesus. Because that's what it's all about. If you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ tonight, if you need the prayers of the church on your behalf, we invite you to come right now as we stand and sing.